and welcome back to Unearth the Past, a family history and genealogy podcast brought to you by me, Dr. Michaela Hume. Much for jumping on. I know you have a very busy schedule. So thank you very much for popping on again and taking the time. What have you been up to since we last spoke?
Oh, all sorts. So the latest one yesterday, despite the super moon and the really high tide, I went down to give a little check to the local handball lifeboat.
Right.
I do talks around the area, and if it's for a charity, I don't generally take a fee. I say, yeah. Well, give it to the lifeboat. So we went down there and we had a little tour of the lifeboat station and handed over a cheque to them, which was quite nice. So it was, quite a fun day. So a bit of that and a lot of research. Been looking into a few trees, some for the TV, some for private clients. So, in fact, I'll show you this. Just finished doing that, getting it ready for the preview.
So what you can't, if you're watching us on YouTube, you'll just see that Paul has picked up the most humongous book. It looks very thick, Paul. So is that a family tree that you've just finished?
Yeah, it's 2.2 pounds it weighs.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. In so pages, folks, that's a lot of pages.
It's a lot. So I just had to finish it all off, tidy it all up and getting it off to the printers, hopefully tonight or tomorrow. So I'll be able to pick it up, get it out to the client next week. So that'd be good.
Yeah, and have you been doing, I know you mentioned about the lifeboats, but have you been doing any more talks, any TV stuff since we last spoke?
Yeah, I've had a bit of a trip up to Macclesfield.
Right near me.
Which was interesting because I was meant to be going to Congleton.
Right.
It was the day of the work to rule on the round. Right. So it's 5 hours up there, hours filming, 5 hours back, and it'll probably be like 2 minutes on the screen at the end of it. But it's the quality that counts.
Now, you know, Paul, that I occasionally am the historian on a ghost show.
Yeah.
Well, so yesterday, right, I'm researching this family tree. Now, can I just put it out there, folks? I don't know whether I believe or not. I've yet to really be convinced, but I'm very open to the, you know, I'm open to it, right? So let's just leave it there. Anyway, I'm researching this family tree, and the person that I'm researching it for is somebody who's coming on the podcast. And I reached out to them and I said, oh, can you just let me know? Can you just tell me what so-and-so's dad was called? And she replied and said, yeah, he was called this. But, he didn't really get on with his dad, so I don't know much about it. Anyway, I'm on the computer and within a few minutes, I've found out that his dad has passed away. And I've also managed to get a photograph of the grave. So I've sent that over and I've gone, I think he died in this year. Oh, and here's a picture of his grave. So she replied and said, yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's him. That's the person. So then last night she goes to bed, right? And in the middle of the night, a son has got like, you know, one of those piano things that like start playing, you know, like when you're a kid and you've got those piano things, right? So in the middle of the night, this piano starts playing. It's switched off. It's not like battery operated. You've got to plug it in. It's not plugged in, right? And it's switched off and it starts playing. She manages to get it to stop playing, goes back to bed. Only been in bed a short time. It starts again. So the only way she got it to stop playing was by soaking it in a load of water, like literally like soaking it in a load of water in the middle of the night, right? So this morning I go for my run and I'm just coming back on from a run and she rings me And she says, look, I've just spoke to so-and-so's sister who knows more about the dad. And it turns out he loved to play the piano. Right? He loved to play the piano, right? And if we just go back to the day before, I've sent her this picture of the headstone, and I'm explaining that the gap at the bottom of the headstone is because four people can go in that plot. And there's only three people in it. So the gap is when that person goes in, they'll obviously fill out the details of the person on the headstone. Well, anyway, overnight, how weird is this, right? So we've got the piano going off in the middle of the night that is just going off for no reason. And then overnight, the gentleman's second wife passes away. Oh. And that is the person who will be going in the plot and will fill out the bottom of the headstone. So, look, I'm not saying that, you know, it could all just be a coincidence. But, but as I say, he loved to play the piano. And in the middle of the night, the piano starts going. And her husband, whose dad it is that was sort of doing the trio, he's an entertainer himself. So I said, maybe he came back and he wanted a bit of a duet. Do you know what I mean? He's like, you sing and I'll play the piano. Who knows? But what a weird, spooky thing to happen. So, yeah, look, not saying I believe in ghosts, even though I do a ghost show. I'm just purely there with the history. I'm just there with the facts. But it was just a bit of an odd event that I thought, oh, I'll share with our podcast community because I know that they'll like it. And then I was thinking, driving today, I thought, oh, yeah, I'll share with our podcast community, you know, the UTPs, the Unearth the Past podcast community. But then I thought, that sounds like some sort of disease, doesn't it, that you need an antibiotic for, a UTP? Yeah, the UTP community.
I know what you mean. I mean, obviously, you know, I do a bit of work now, thanks to you, for the same program.
Yeah.
And I mean, I can't really talk about the story I found, one of the stories I found.
It's
probably one of the most horrendous stories I've ever come across. And I can't really say more than that because it will give it away.
No.
But really, yeah, it's a shocker, absolute shocker, this story. And let's just say you wouldn't want this one coming back in the middle of the night. You really wouldn't.
Just to say as well, folks, when those programs go to air, I will let you know. So when me and Paul know when they actually come out, we'll let you know. We do start actually filming something else in a few weeks, but that's a secret, so I can't tell you any more about it. So that's it. Can I just say as well, massive thank you to everybody that gets in contact every week. I read all your messages. I am going to reply to some more, I think, today. I think I've got some time this evening, so I'll sit down and reply to those. If you are stuck with your family tree and you want to reach out to me or Paul, please, you can do so via my website, which is www.michaelahume.com. Send me a message and I'll pass it on to Paul. Or, look, if you just want to book us for an event, you know, if you think I quite fancy a bit of, you know, genealogy and stand-up, book Paul. If you just want to book me, because I'll chat for half an hour, feel free to get in touch. Right, okay, so this week, let's not go off. I've got to try and get these podcasts down to 30 minutes, and it's so hard, Paul, especially for, because we normally film, don't we, way over an hour. But I'm focused today. Right, there is nothing more annoying in life than ordering a birth certificate and seeing that flat line for where the father is. Just nothing more annoying. So today we're going to talk about, you know, hints and tips. How can we get around it? Stories that maybe will help you. Things that we've encountered in our research. Paul, kick us off. So I know Paul has done some fantastic family trees for regular people like me. But also, you know, he has looked into some Hollywood superstar family trees and so forth. So have you come across, Paul, I'd say in every family tree, you generally come across somebody who is illegitimate. Would you agree?
Yeah, well, they estimate that round about 10% of all births are not to the father that they're meant to be.
Yeah.
despite whatever it may say on the birth certificate. So it's very common. Very rare you get one that's not to the right mother, but the right father is something else. That happens quite a lot. And I suppose it's fine if you know that. So if you know someone's born out of wedlock, as they would have said, or whatever. So if you go to a parish record from years ago, you look in there, and generally it would say, name of the father, name of the mother, name of the child, when they were baptised. It might tell you where they lived, or it might tell you what they did for a living. But occasionally, depending on the vicar in charge, you will just have to say the mother's name. And it might say things like baseball child or natural child of. So if it's baseball, it means, you know, they weren't married. If it's a natural child of, quite often it will have both names of the parents, but it will be indicating that the parents weren't married. It's just that the kind of, if you like, the man is owning up to being the father of the child. And then you get you go to Scotland and you look through like the Presbyterian records, and they're all fire and brimstone, and they'll just say illegitimate or bastard. You know, you'll see this written into the parish records. And sometimes you see a little, there'll be a little homily in there berating the woman generally, you know, for having a child out of wedlock and how she was ashamed to her parents and this kind of stuff. But I've mainly seen that in Scotland rather than in England. So that's kind of straightforward, because you can sometimes draw inferences from that, who the parents might be or who the father might be. The problem you get is when you get a birth certificate, and as you say, it's just got a line, and you don't know who it is. And then you've got to start looking for clues. And, I find these in families. So I did, if you look at someone like Tom Hardy, out of interest, I just did his tree years ago. And actually, his name should probably be Tom Edgemore.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Original family name. You look at Robbie Williams on his Farrell line. I traced his grandfather's line. And you find a baby that's born, but it's born 3 years after the father died. Mm. And then you look on the census and you start trying to find clues to why this could be. And we can come on to some of the clues. And then Fred Dynage. I did Fred Dynage's tree, and we did a bit on Meridian about it down here on ITV. And, he had an ancestor at the Battle of Waterloo. He had an ancestor who was a relative that was on the Titanic. But he also had an ancestor who was meant to be from his great-great-great-whatever grandparents, but was actually the child of their daughter. And the grandparents or the great-grandparents had taken on that child as their own. So, again, you have to then start looking for clues to what could cause this. I mean, the obvious thing to do is DNA, but there are other things you can do if you haven't gone that far.
I was going to say as well, it was common that people did take on children. Not only, for example, grandparents taking on their grandkids as if they're their kids, but also neighbours and friends took in people's children. Just because, and it's worth bearing this in mind, the father isn't present, for example, on a parish record, on a baptism, doesn't necessarily mean that the child was illegitimate. And I'm sure you'll back me up with this. Sometimes the registrar or whoever it is who's conducting the ceremony wouldn't put the father on if he wasn't present. So he might have been away at war, for example, and therefore he's not actually named on the baptism. I've got it with a case at the moment exactly the same as what you've said. So when you go back into the family tree, if you go back to the great-great-grandmother, she's actually given her son her maiden name, in effect, right? And we don't know who the dad is. Now, even with DNA, the likelihood is I would not be able to find that out, because I remember chatting to Laura House, brilliant DNA expert, about this. And she said, when you're going back to sort of great-great-grandparents, it is difficult to pinpoint who it is. It's not as straightforward if it's a closer relation. Even using DNA probably wouldn't help me that much in that situation. But there are clues, as you've said, Paul, that we can, you know, we can look out for. If we go back and maybe we start with parish record, a clue is sometimes in the name, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, what you'll find is it was very difficult for a woman to name a father, as you say. If you didn't want to be named, if you denied it, it was illegal by the time birth certificates come out to put someone's name down if he denied it. It was like a libelous thing to do. So with parish records, what would often happen is that the child might have the same first name as the father, or it might be given a middle name, which is an unusual name, you know, like Jones or something like that for a middle name. So what the woman would do is hint, because she could give the child any name she wanted. So she would hint at the father's surname in the middle name of the child. So quite often, if you see a surname as a middle name, and obviously the father wasn't present when the baptism took place, you've probably got a clue as to who the father really was. So that's an obvious one.
Another record, which is quite useful if we're thinking about that period of parish records, are bastardy bonds. So these can be really useful. So if, for example, if a woman has had a child in the parish, the likelihood is that she is going to need to claim relief. So she is going to need parish assistance. Now, the parish are not too pleased about this and they don't want to pay for it. So what they then do is track down the father. He may be in that parish, he may be in another parish, and they will basically charge him. They will make him pay for whatever they're paying to keep basically his child. So that's kind of what they are in a nutshell. Now, you can find these often in overseers' records, in poor law records, also in sort of quarter sessions, you may find them. It is a document that I have used, but I've used bastardy books, which come a bit later. So I've used bastardy books from the mid-20th century. And that is basically a book of all the women, and they were just women in this book, that had taken men to court claiming that they were the father of their child, and the father had to pay maintenance to that child till it's a certain age. Now, in the case that I was looking at, it was proven that he was the father. I don't quite know how they did that without DNA. But, you know, it was proven that he was the father and he had to pay so much money until the child, I think, was 16, right? So there are bastardy bonds and there are bastardy books. But poor law records are great. And if you've ever read poor law minute books, they are really interesting, aren't they, Paul? You know, it's not just, I know we're talking about illegitimate ancestors today, but it's like, you know, they gave so-and-so so much for a pair of shoes, or they paid for a coffin for somebody. They are really worth checking out because it does mention people by name. But again, you would need to know what parish they lived in.
Yeah, you could also remove all records. So if a pauper has gone from their parish of birth, and quite often they would have gone to London or somewhere like that, and they turn up and they're still a pauper, the parish officers will say, well, where are you from and who do all these kids belong to? And they would find out, before they would give any relief, the original parish that the person was from, and they'd want to know about the father of the children so they could, you know, interrogate usually the woman about this, but sometimes whole families. And they can sometimes hold clues to say, okay, well, although they're turning up in London where you don't expect them, you see the removal records and they've been removed back to, you know, Lancashire or to Southwark, south of the river, or wherever it might be. And sometimes you get notes in there where the woman will say her piece and talk about her family, talk about why she's poor, talk about why the father isn't there. So you can get clues from that. The other interesting thing is with the bastardy records, sometimes you see guys suddenly joining the army or the navy. And if these guys were being pursued for maintenance, effectively, joined the army or the navy, quite often they could get exemption from having to pay for their children while they were serving. So they'd be liable, you know, if they weren't serving, but while they were serving. So all of a sudden you might see a guy from a village suddenly turn up in a troop of dragoons or join HMS Cyclades or whatever in Portsmouth. and he's running away from his responsibilities so he doesn't have to pay this money. So it's a subtle clue, but the things like that can give you clues. But if you find him in those records and it says he's joined the Army or the Navy, then you've got another route to travel to find out what happened to him after that. And it's probably easy to track. Does he go back to his village and, you know, marry the girl, or does he go off somewhere else, or what happened?
Also, if you get a birth certificate and the father isn't named, it's always worth, isn't it, Paul, just checking out the baptism record.
Yeah.
Because sometimes, you know, it may have been when she's, as I said before, when she's gone to register the birth, for whatever reason, the father isn't present, right? But when it comes to the baptism, it may be that he is present, or it may be that, I don't know, you know, a lot of children get baptized quite a bit, don't they, after they were born, maybe within the first year or so. It might be that the couple have got together and they're now married, but they just weren't together at the time that the birth was registered. So I would say, if you are getting a flat line, you know, that horizontal line that we all hate on a birth certificate, don't let it put you off in that respect. You know, go and check out the baptism, because he may be listed on the baptism record.
The other thing you find is sometimes someone will be brought up as a child with one name, and then later in life, they'll change their surname. And this happened to me. My mum's mum, so my nan, I always believed that her surname was Kimber.
Mm.
I could never find her in the records. And I searched and searched and searched. They came from a place near Basingstoke and then up to London. I could never find her in the records anywhere, Martha Kimber. And then years later, years after she died, I was talking to one of my aunts about it. And I said, yeah, I could never find your mum in the records. I was looking up, you know, Martha Kimber. I said, the only one I could find that was like close, that seemed to be something to do with it, was someone called Wise, W-I-S-E. And my aunt went, oh, yeah, she used that name sometimes. And I was, what? I've spent 10 years trying to find her. And what it was, her mum was a maid at a house in Egham in London. And her father was a guy whose family owned a dairy there, and he was working as a milkman. Knocked at the door every morning, made it open the door. He'd chat her up, you know, Ernie, fastest milkman in the West, all of this. And basically he got pregnant, and his family were quite well-to-do. Although he was a milkman, he was actually working for his father's company, you know. So his name was Kimber. Her name was Wise at the time. She got pregnant. Unfortunately, it was right at the time when doctors took over from midwives to deliver babies, and they introduced forceps, but they didn't understand the concept of germ theory and cleanliness. So this doctor had delivered the baby, and my great-grandmother contracted pure purple fever, which is basically where they don't wash the forceps properly, they don't disinfect them between births. If one woman has got an infection, they spread it to all the other women that they deliver with those forceps. And this is why deaths of births from doctors was much higher in the early years than it was from midwives. Because midwives did everything by hand, you know, wash their hands in carbolic afterwards and all this kind of thing. So they were actually cleaner than the implements that the doctors were using. Anyway, cut a long story short, the mother died. The baby was born, and then the parents, obviously, of her pursued this family that was well off, because they knew who it was. They knew who the father was, because she'd obviously told them. Not written anywhere. So they pursued them, and what happened was they took the baby and they gave her to an elderly aunt and uncle of the milkman who had no children of their own. So I found this Martha Wise, who then became Martha Kimber, living with the Kimbers, but they were like, you know, 50-odd years older than her. So it's very unlikely they were the parents. And it turned out that they were an aunt and uncle that agreed they never had children, they wanted them, and they took her in, and they raised her. And then through her life, she either used the name Kimber or she used the name Wise. So kind of almost worse than not knowing a name is knowing the wrong name, because you keep hitting that brick wall where you can't get any further. And on the same point, when you, it's the worst thing isn't having a birth certificate with no name on it, because then you have to just start looking. The worst thing, as in my case, was having a birth certificate with your father's name on it, but he's not your father. So my dad was my dad, but he wasn't my biological father, but his name was on my birth certificate.
And how old were you, Paul, when you figured that
64.
Out? So for those that have not listened to the podcast before, Paul has spoke to us about his shock, actually, at doing a DNA test at the age of 64. Yeah, and finding out that his dad was not his biological father.
All of my family died without telling me. They all knew that my dad wasn't my dad. My dad knew.
I was going to say, did you think, obviously, I know your dad knew, but did you think that they, do you think they knew as well? Do you think everybody knew? Like, you know, do you think it was?
Well, I know everybody knew because I've called up one of my my last living cousin that's older than me. Or the last one that's older than me that's still living, he's 80. And I've told this story before, and I just asked him, were there any, he was 13 when I was born. So I said, you know, were there any stories about me at birth? And he was very sort of reluctant at first to talk about it. He said, well, you know, let me get back to you. Then his wife had a chat to him, because even she knew, and said, Stevie, just tell him. So he phoned me back, and he said, yeah, you know, this is what happened. And he told me a few stories. Obviously, he was only 13. He didn't know the full story, but he knew enough to give me a clue. And then the DNA let me track down the real family, you know.
When you found that out, and I know that there's going to be people listening to this, right, who are probably in a similar situation to you, how did it make you feel about the people that knew? Were you kind of a bit bitter that they not told you, or were you just like, you know what, they were young as well and it is what it is?
I was just surprised, really. I mean, I thought, you know, play the game. One of you could have told me. Once one of them was dead, the other one could have said something, you know, because they all died. By the time I was, you know, in my 20s, my brother was dead, my mum was dead, my dad was dead. So they're all gone early in my life, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So I grew up without any of them. And not one single person ever mentioned the situation. So it just shows you, even in modern times where it doesn't really matter, people think it matters. And they keep it back for you. I mean, I wasn't upset, because it's like, well, I can't do anything about it. You know, my dad was my dad. The other bloke effectively was a sperm donor, and these things happen. You know, that's kind of life. And you've got to get on with it. And, you know, I've turned out lovely. Look at me, you know.
That's debatable, folks. That's debatable.
but it shows you the secrets they even kept nowadays, let alone when there was a huge shame to being born out of wedlock. So you never know what you're going to find. And years ago, I mean, it had, you know, legal and financial implications. I've mentioned before, I did a family tree on the vampire lord of Hurstbourne Priors, you know, an English aristocrat, Earl of Portsmouth, who was denounced as a vampire in, like, 1821 in the British court. And basically, he was mentally ill, and he'd been duped by the woman he married. He'd been duped by Lord Byron into marrying her. There's all sorts. It's such a story. And she was sleeping with a man who claimed to be her doctor, and obviously he wasn't, but she got pregnant. And as soon as the pregnancy happened, the situation became really serious, because his brother didn't believe that this was his child, because the guy was quite naive. And in court, they cross-examined him to see if he understood how men and women make a baby. And he kind of didn't really know. I mean, this guy was like probably in his 50s by then. It was like he didn't really know how it happened. So they decided that this child couldn't inherit. And the line passed across to his brother, because there were serious implications. So no real proof. Funnily enough, the daughter grew up. I mean, lots of different things happened to the family. But the daughter grew up and ran a pub in Surrey in the end. She married a policeman and ran a pub up on the canal up at Newhay in Surrey. So there you go.
When I was looking into the family tree that I'm doing at the moment, I knew, actually, when I ordered the marriage certificate of this particular person, late Victorian period, I thought, that name seems familiar. And the dad on the marriage certificate, when it says, you know, rank and profession of the father and whatever, was actually the granddad. And that was when alarm bells started to go for me. And I thought, okay, so the mother has obviously just told, you know, told her son, put down your granddad, you know, put somebody on there. I know, let's put your granddad on there. You know, it saves the sort of the stigma of you being illegitimate. And the mum had married, she'd remarried by this point. She'd sort of had this child out of wedlock. And then it was only a few years later that actually she remarried. And the guy obviously had a pretty good relationship with her. You know, he is living with her and her husband and his half siblings, I think on the 1911 census. And in the family plot, she's buried in the family plot with him and his wife. So they obviously had a good relationship, but on his marriage certificate, the name of the father is actually the grandfather. We don't know who the father is.
So that's and interesting. Again,
yeah, I was going to say, and again, yeah, it's
great source, aren't they? Because brilliant. Sometimes the child will just, because there's no legal reason why a child shouldn't write on there. So if their mum has told them who they think their dad was, sometimes if you get a marriage certificate, this strange name will come up. And it's that may be the true father. In that case, obviously it wasn't. But, you know, sometimes you can get a clue from that.
Now, DNA, right? So obviously DNA is huge. I work with a lot of people who are looking for their birth parents, and it just would not be possible to find their birth parents without DNA. I know Laura's been on and she said that, you know, when you get your DNA results, you really want to focus on your cousin matches. Try and group them into have a look who their matches are and colour coordinate them, put them into groups as to who they're related to, right? So if I unpick that a bit, so click on a cousin match, see who they share DNA with and whack them in a group. And what you should end up with is distinct groups of people that share DNA with each other. This will help you sort of plot your tree. You will end up probably doing family trees for these people to figure out how they are intimately connected, which, let me tell you, might take forever. But it is definitely worth doing. We will be doing another session on DNA, but if you haven't seen our chat with Laura House, I will put a link to that episode in the description below. Paul,
I'd say the other thing on that is to look for very strong links to family names that you've got absolutely no connection with in the tree.
Yeah,
that's how I found my side of it. It was that gave it away. Too many really close links to names that had no bearing on my tree that I'd done from the certificates, and that's a strong clue.
Obviously, you use DNA, right? And I know we've mentioned this before on the podcast, but you have used DNA to find out who your biological father is, right? Have you used DNA in other family trees you've been doing to help solve illegitimate ancestors? Like, has it proved pretty useful for you?
Yeah, yes and no. It really depends how far back it happened. Mm. So the problem, as you know, is every generation, you lose half your genes from the previous generation. So, you don't get a mixture of everything. You get half of what your father's got, half of what your mother's got, and the rest is thrown away. So that's disappeared. So in five generations, you could potentially lose more or less everything from the people before that. So it can be quite difficult. Why chromosomes and mitochondrial DNA are different? Because they tend to come down, you know, as they are, mitochondrial DNA to everyone through your mother. Y chromosome DNA, obviously, only through the male line, but it's a really good indicator in the male line of who the father, grandfather, et cetera, are. But then it's less refined than the autosomal DNA, which has lots and lots of patterns in it. So the Y chromosome, like with my one, I mean, you know, it could be one of three brothers, my real father. So I don't know who the actual father is. And then you have to start looking at time, age, and geography for opportunity. So are they old enough? Were they in the right area at the right time? And Well, I say time, age, and opportunity. Yeah. So, and geography. So, they're in the right area at the right time. Were they there at the right time? And are they of the right age? Were they married or not married? Because that would generally make a difference. So, you have to start looking at things like that. And you may never know for sure. And if they've died, it's only supposition then.
So, we have hopefully given you some hints and tips. So, check out Bastardy Bonds. As I say, have a look in those poor law records. Also quarter sessions. You know, did somebody take the gentleman to court to try and get maintenance? There are Bastardy books. As I say, I've looked at them in the mid-20th century. Again, check out your local records office because not every records office has them. But it was, when I searched through them, it was basically just a list of everybody who'd been to court, like a family court, and whether they had been proven to be the father or not, whether they had to pay maintenance and how long they paid maintenance for. So that's quite useful. Also, don't forget what Paul said, have a look at the names. Names are important. You know, if you've got a middle name and you think it's a surname, could that be the mother sort of secretly giving a little nod to the biological father of the child? Again, like in my case, look at official documents and question them. You know, if a dad has appeared on a marriage certificate and you're not quite sure who it is, you know, when you do a bit more of the family tree, you might find out, as in what I found out this week, it was actually a grandfather and not a father at all. Then obviously DNA is probably the most obvious. As Paul mentioned, because we lose DNA as we go back, so obviously we get 50% from mum and dad and then 25%, and then it's getting less and less and less. It is quite difficult to use DNA to find, for example, a great-great-great-grandfather. And that is just because of the DNA is obviously getting less and less, and it just does prove quite problematic. Not impossible, it would just take you a bit more time. That's all. Paul has obviously revealed today about the shock, I know he's spoken about before, of being 64, finding out that his dad was not his biological father, and also how he used DNA to solve that. Now, if you're listening to this and you have got an illegitimate ancestor and you have managed to crack it and find out who the biological father is, yeah, so get in touch. If you have managed to crack and find those illegitimate, the fathers of those illegitimate children, please get in touch. I've got it actually because my granddad's half-sister, we don't know who her dad was. And unfortunately, she never married. It's a really sad story, actually. I think she was engaged once in about the 1920s. And whatever happened, they never got married. And she never had another man after that. That was just it. She lived a life on her own. And sadly, she's passed away and she's got no children. So there's nobody I can DNA test to find out who Auntie Thelma's dad is. But yeah, I know. DNA just came a bit too late for us, I think, in that regard.
Just one more thing. If I go missing after the 12th of October, it's because I'm doing a chat at NAPO, which is the National Association of Retired Police Officers. So I'm doing a chat to them. We've got a curry and a beer afterwards, I've been promised, so that's quite good. I'm just hoping it's not a sting, and they're trying to get me in there so that they can get me for all my my past misdemeanors. Who knows?
Listen, I'm tipping them off. I'll be ringing up Crime Stoppers the week before, Paul. I'll be spilling the beans.
He was the one that we caught in the London Metropolitan Archives at 4 a.m.
Yeah, that was him. Yes. Thank you so much, folks, for listening. Really, really appreciate it. Honestly, every week I say this. I'm still surprised by how many people are tuning in. We get more and more people every week from all over the world. So thank you very, very much. If there's a topic we haven't spoke about that you want to talk about, I know one of our listeners got in touch with me and said she'd love to hear something on the asylum. which I will be doing in the next few weeks. I'm hoping to get in by the end of September. Get in touch. So if there's something we haven't spoke about, get in touch, and we will be sure to speak about it. Have a fantastic week researching. Hopefully we'll give you a bit of inspiration, and don't get too downhearted if you come across an illegitimate ancestor. And I shall see you again next week. Take care.
Bye.